There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jimmy hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Hello, everyone. It's that time of the week. Actually, the inaugural version of the Phil Pritchett podcast. Fort Worth, Texas, the inaugural edition here. We'll be joining you once a week to discuss all things music. Coming up today, we're going to talk about the pros and cons of modern radio. Does it matter? My friend Kurt South is here with me today. How's it going, South?
It is great. Everything is wonderful. I'm anxious to tackle the question you just brought up.
Well, we're going to discuss some radio. On this show, we're going to do some segments, a little business news at the top of some radio today. Then we're going to get into what's been going on in Phil Pritchett world, Phil world, everything from the new albums, the new songs, who's been recording here at Trinidad World Recording. And then finally get into some music talk here at the end of the hour. I'm sure Kurt will have some opinions on what essential albums maybe you don't own that he is smart enough to already own. That kind of thing. Stuff that I own that you don't and stuff like that. But let's get into radio because it's Kurt and I are, of course, songwriters, struggling, perpetually struggling songwriters. Kurt plays all over here at Fort Worth, the full band and I. We've been banging around and... both of us are here. The only thing you can really say about us is we've survived. That's the only feather in our cap, really.
Yeah, we've stuck it out years in an industry that eats people alive, seemingly. So,
indeed.
You know, I think that there's something to be said for surviving. You know.
Well, it is.
It's not glorious.
No, it is not. The vomit, the blood, the broken dreams. Yeah. But at some point, I think. You know, you are shattered beyond a point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're ground to sand, but, you know, you find a way to continue.
Yeah, no question.
And that's
no
what
question.
Keeps those guys. Yeah, I used to not believe those rock biographies I'd read, you know, the guys that had it so rough. I was like, well, I'll never be like that, you know.
And I'm here you are living
I'm
the
never
dream.
Gonna be that kind of a musician, a real one, I used to say.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
But now I am one, you know. I'm just walking around in my beat-up car.
You're a lifer. You look back one day, and if you live according to what the medical community tells us a man was going to live these days, just half your life has been spent.
That's right.
Doing this, and you're not going to change now.
That's right. You know?
I turned 33 this week, and I think
happy birthday.
Well, thank you. I'll give an address where you can send gifts and cards later.
It changes weekly.
But you know, I was thinking, yeah, I'm approaching my mid 30s, midlife crisis just around the corner.
For you, you probably already passed your midlife.
Yeah,
crisis.
My midlife crisis was when I was 23. But you know, I'm kind of a lifer. You know, this is kind of what I do.
You are who you are at this point.
Yeah, and no matter what profession you're in, I have a lawyer friend of mine who he's about my age, and he kind of feels the same way about being an attorney.
Yeah.
He's like, man, I'm my mid-30s. What else am I going to do? I've done it this long. So.
Well, I think the lesson is, yeah, that it is difficult to do what you love to do, you know, as we've said in songs and stuff like that before.
Sure.
Topic we continually touch on. It's always frustrating when someone comes up to the gig and says, man, why aren't you on the radio, man? How come I never hear you on the radio, dude? And it's always kind of a tough thing to answer. Because the truth is, as you and I know, it is a big game to play. And it can have an effect. I mean, there are radio stations that do seem to matter.
Yeah, no question. No question. I think the main issue with radio is that getting on the radio is a full-time endeavor in and of itself. That's why there are the radio promoters that exist solely to get guys like you and me on to radio stations.
That's right.
On our end, that requires a large capital infusion. It costs a lot of money.
Capital infusion, a large amount of money.
A large
money
amount
that
of money.
Musicians may not have.
Yes, to get on the radio. Mm-hmm. And you and I, we put out a new song, a new album, whatever. We have a couple options. Do we just try to work this off of our own website, spread it amongst our fan base, hope they market it to other people for us, and use our money to buy new guitars or a new van or whatever the alternative is? Or do
groceries.
We, groceries.
Pay the mortgage. The finer point is, you know, does it, there's no question that, you know, in the 80s and 90s and you know, back before that, you know, radio had the nation's ear. I mean, people did
sure,
listen to the
yeah.
radio to find out what was going on, you know, that when you know, when I was in grade school and I heard the new Def Leppard song, you know, Pyromania
yeah.
was coming out. You're just right. like, man, I gotta be right there. I gotta go get that record. You know, I wanna be in with the what's
finger
going
was on. The finger was on the pulse of the
that's
culture.
That's right, yeah. But,
the
but there's no question, I think, and we've talked about this, that's just that's less and less true.
Right,
as the years
right.
go by, there's just other ways people get exposed to music.
Right.
And like we were saying, you know, the radio's just not the trusted filter that no. it once was.
Well, I tell people, and this dates me, but my wife tells me this when I mention this story. I tell people who don't remember what I call the golden age of radio. When I was...
Hey, sports fan.
yeah. Joe Buck in the background. Now, when I was in high school in Virginia... XL 102 was the local rock station.
Right, right.
And man, it didn't matter what kind of, if as long as you weren't Travis Tritt or Alan Jackson type country,
yeah, yeah.
if you were anything else, you mattered, you were on XL 102. I first heard Steve Earle on that radio station. And this was a rock and roll radio station where they played Boston and Def Leppard and the Beatles and
right.
the Stones. But then the new Steve Earle single comes out, and they put it on there.
Makes me stay when I need to go, don't it show? And the way that I'm back out of the room, I'd rather watch your eyes than my own step.
Well, here's, you know, the thing is any musician, I hope that people listening to this show are fans of music in general, but you know, are probably more you know, Texas fans, rock and roll, country thing. But they're tuning in here on the Phil World podcast, whatever we're going to call this thing. You know, I think I, like a lot of guys in the late '90s, had some experience of trying to get on radio and the importance of that. And you know, I did pay a girl at one point for radio.
Oh, not nearly as interesting.
I was just like walking right in with a beam, just coming at your head, and just like, I need to duck.
You teed yourself up there for a
second. This gal was going to get me on radio stations all over the country, the world, and elsewhere. So, you know, I'm not going to get into the fine details of it. A check was written. That's all I'm going to say. A check was written that may or may not have bounced. I don't know. I was struggling in those days. A little worse than I am now. Struggling. But I had to get on the radio. I had to get that radio play, man. You
yeah.
know? Get those ASCAP checks rolling in. So we did. We paid for it. And a couple months later, indeed, I got a sheet of paper with a lot of cryptic, you know, K's and R's and, you know, lists of people who had supposedly played something off the album, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But that was kind of it, you know? I didn't know. You had to... You know, they still had to buy records. They couldn't. There wasn't an internet. You know,
right.
they could download stuff. So you had to. Hey, we got a few spins in St. Louis or in Phoenix. You know, what do you do with that information? Race out there and play an in store at the Walmart or
yeah.
Or the local mom and pop shop. You know, and
yeah.
So it is. It was a tough deal, but the guys who were succeeding were getting played. You know, and
right.
of course part of a major label kind of thing. But of course I was an indie guy, so you're trying to. It's a tough deal to, you know, you can't bang heads with the major label type acts, you know.
No.
Especially now with just millions of them, you know, walking the streets, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to play the new Peter Gabriel album, you know? Sting puts out a new record? Who cares?
We're
I mean,
competing
really.
With those guys now.
And we're competing, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, that's another thing people don't, another pitfall that people, that guys like you and I deal with is just the competition is,
mm-hmm.
is always
it's
just
fierce.
People say, you know, we don't compete with like U2 or something. But let me tell you what, man. If I'm playing at Adair's, and U2's down the street at the AAC, man, It's going to kill me, South.
It will. It will kill
you. It's going to hurt that tip jar down there.
It will hurt your Adair's tip jar. It'd be a lonely night at Adair's when you two comes to town. That's the moral of this story. I think you're absolutely right. It's hard to disseminate that information that you get from the radio stations or from the promoters and say, man, is this doing me any good? Does this translate into the sales? Is it worth it? Am I constantly garnering new fans by being on this radio format? I have very limited radio experience. I've never paid anybody to promote the album or anything to radio. I have gotten a regional play on a lot of different independent stations, things
indeed,
like that.
Indeed, indeed.
But, you know, it's always been the DJ or the program director saying, hey, I like this album, I like this song, I'm going to play it. It's been an informal thing, really. And, you know, in some cases I've seen, a few people showed up at a gig who might not have been there otherwise and said, hey, we heard your song on the radio. But, man, for the most part, my fans have either seen me play live before.
Yeah.
Or a trusted friend told them, hey, you need to check this guy out, you'll like him. Or they stumbled upon me on the internet, and that's it. Now, that if I had tons of radio play in the past, would it be a different story? Who knows?
Well, there's also, you and I know guys we were talking about earlier, who shall remain nameless on our show for our
yes,
purposes.
Please.
Who have paid recently big money and, is, yes. and have received huge radio play.
Yes.
That you can just go right down to the White Elephant, pony up $2 and see them play their top 10 hit to a room full of drunks.
Or a room not full of drunks.
A room empty of drunks.
Yeah, I mean, I know guys who've spent a small fortune to get that radio playing, have done well as far as the charts go, but that hasn't translated into people paying to get in the door to see them.
That's right.
And if I were in that situation, I'd be pissed.
So is radio, you know, what is the future of radio, do you think? Are people listening in the cars?
I think people have their own radio stations called iPods, and they can program, put whatever the hell they
want
on.
Now they can put our show on there, you know?
This show will find its way onto dozens of iPods.
Dozens of iPods worldwide.
If we're lucky.
Will we listen to this?
I think that control and that the power is in the hands of the consumer now more than ever. They decide what they want to hear when they want to hear it.
And there's a lot of news now about, it's really just the changing media is really what this little segment of the day is about. You do have, all the news about the newspapers closing.
Mm-hmm.
The Rocky Mountain News out of business.
Dallas Morning News is having huge cutbacks.
Huge cutbacks. There's some murmurings about the Star-Telegram perhaps merging with the Dallas Morning News. You know, where they can share writers and all that kind of stuff. And there is so where we get our news, and that's really what radio is and was in its heyday. It was where you got your music news, so to speak, where you heard new songs, where you knew, hey, when I go to Sound Warehouse, you know, to use a name from the graveyard.
Wow.
But, you know, to go in there and say, man, what do I want to get, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you roll in there and you know, man, I want to get that new Smithereens album I just heard on the radio.
Oh, yeah.
You know, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
We're the only people buying Smithereens albums.
Man, back in 1992, there was a lot of us, man. Green Thoughts and 11 All the Classics.
House That We Used to Live In. What were the other big ones they had?
Oh, Girl Like You.
Only a Memory.
Room Without a View. Yeah, oh yeah.
He told me recently that the lead singer for the Smithereens, Pat D'Annunzio,
yes,
big conservative political activist guy.
Very big conservative political activist.
And also big, weighs 400 pounds, is that right?
Yeah, he has a
glandular,
sort of, thyroid disorder, something like that, that's caused him to, you know, he's always been a real in shape,
guy,
you know.
And wearing a beret and a goatee,
playing
intelligent pop songs in the 80s. Early 90s.
Yeah, he's apparently it was a life-threatening illness that he has to take some steroids now that keeps his weight way up. But what's funny, and to his credit, he's out there rocking as hard as ever.
Hell yeah, man.
Despite being as large
as that's the roids, man. That roids will get you out there.
I saw on YouTube a video of them.
There's no testing. There's no roids testing in music.
No
roids
testing.
You can use all the roids you want.
If there was drug testing in music, how many people would still be in the business?
You have to test positive for drugs to keep going. I
mean, if you come out clean, they put you on a one-year ban.
Yeah.
But I think to get back to the...
Man, we got off on the throw him out.
He pissed clean. He's gone.
Drinking water on the stage. Getting rid of that guy.
Boy, we went from going into Sound Warehouse
Radio
to the smithereens
to the size of Patanesia.
To steroids.
Well, that's going to wrap up this little first edition of Radio Talk, talking about the importance of radio. Is it a dinosaur? Oh, we don't know. So Kurt and I, people like us everywhere, hopefully, indie guys, hopefully with some talent, hopefully with some imagination, do a little talk and music, bring it to you. If you want to hear it, great. It's the P2 Podcast. Coming up in our next segment, we're going to talk about what's been going on recently here in Trinidad World Recording in Fort Worth, at the studio, some stuff we've been producing and recording, including Kurt's new stuff himself. And then coming up, we're going to get into Phil's vault, which can include old Pritchett recordings, full band stuff, and or records that I have that you don't and maybe need to. That's all coming up in just a minute. Phil Pritchett here. It's the P2 Podcast. We do it every week. The inaugural show here. We're just feeling our way along here, folks. We don't know what we're doing. We got a couple mics set up here in the room. It's a cold day here, Fort Worth, Texas.
It is.
Early March. Rare. It's been warm. The train's been going by outside. We're here in the studio, though, where we tracked the... we did the Bullfighter Returns in here. We did some records with J.D. Clark and the Slow Rolling Lows and Clay Thrash. And
the great Mike Mathis.
The great Mike Mathis did a great record in here.
Yes.
John's Guns out
Kevin
of College
Smith.
Station. Kevin Smith from Austin.
Did you mention Clay Thrash?
Clay Thrash, of course. Thrash. I think I mentioned Clay. Yeah. And anyway, we got some projects coming in here. Of course, one of the first project I ever produced at the old Stockyards place. You can go on YouTube and watch a little documentary on the making of our High Tide in the Heartland record. The first other band I produced, though, was Kurt South, whose drummer, Stu Wiley, I later stole and added him to the full band. Stu was in the one room. You know, we had Stolly in there, Jason Stolly, his room in there. Put Stu in there. We had who played bass?
The Cobra. The Cobra was on bass.
Corey Nick, yeah.
Yeah. And that was
Cobra
it.
Cobra on
that
bass.
Was the
that
three
was
of
it.
Us. Yeah.
Had my Tascam 2488 recorder in the corner.
Yes.
A couple of mics. We had two mics on the drums, I think. Two mics on the drums, and then
three.
Kurt.
You had a kick drum mic and two overheads.
Yeah, that's right. And some dude out on the street yelling. Some homeless guy just screaming.
The jukebox in the bar below.
Some pigeons in there.
providing background music.
I remember my dad when I rented that place.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, the glass is all smashed out, so I was showing it to him. And he, you know, he's always so supportive. My parents are so supportive. I'm the luckiest guy, really. But, you know, Dad, he looks out for me. So I'm down there walking him through that studio, man, and I felt bad because we went up there, man. There's some garbage and some needles on the ground. And then when I go into the main tracking room, I was like, no, my studio's going to be in here, Dad. We walk in there, and there's just a couple of pigeons in there, just some feathers kind of flew away when we walked in just through a window that had been smashed out. They kind of went out the window. I can see my dad look at his face. He's just like, oh, my gosh.
You didn't tell him you were also
son.
Doing a part-time petting zoo in there?
Yeah, it was kind of like, it's all part of the vision, Dad.
There's also a homeless man curled up in the corner who later on became your first engineer.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, yeah, but Kurt revisited us here. Is this your first thing to do in here, wasn't it, in the new place?
Yeah, that was the we've done demos together here, but it was the first real
Kurt's
project.
A guy who abhors recording himself for long periods of time.
Yeah.
He likes things. So this is you're the kind of guy I like to have in here.
I get beaten down by the recording
process. We heat it up, you play your song, that's it. If it's a little out of tune or something, that's okay. It's just like, you know what? It is what it is.
It is what it is. I'm not afraid.
Bounce it down and put it out.
I'm not afraid to just show it what it for what it is.
The mark of the human hand.
That's
big
right.
Big believer in the
that's
mark
right.
of the human hand.
I've done too many recordings that were so perfect that people were like, man, that sounds pretty good, but it doesn't remind us of you at all.
Doesn't
so
sound
learned,
crappy like you do.
I learned.
Stage.
Yeah, it's not out of tune and warbly like you are live.
Belligerent horse.
So I learned to just keep it as real as possible, to go with the flow. To not get bogged down by finite details that in the end didn't make a difference. Just let's play it well. Let's get it on tape. Let's put it out.
Well, I think that this is an issue I struggle with greatly.
Mm-hmm.
There's something because we produce guys in here, and I don't want to. The last thing I want to do is the guy helping someone make a record. is, and I hope you feel this way, I don't want to impose my kind of idea on it in any way. I mean, obviously, I'm going to record it and mix it, you know, to what I think sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
And if some guy says, hey, man, I really want the toms close mic'd and just booming throughout, great, you know, or,
yeah,
you know, hey, man, we got a double kick pedal or something. That's just what we do. Hey, man, they're, I don't know if that's your sound, whatever. I'm not a big fan, but there you go. So,
right.
But there does come a real difficult line to draw. Maybe you can help me out with this.
Oh, I can help you with this.
There's a, because some guys or ladies, we have some ladies in here recording as well, of course. Everyone's very hard on themselves. I say, you know, doing a recording for somebody, it's like being a professional photographer. Excuse me if you've heard this example before, but I'm going to share it with our listeners. You know, you got the great camera, the space, you got mm-hmm. the technology, the know-how. You light it up. You sit the guy out there. You shoot him from every angle possible. You make him smile. You get the kids laughing. It goes on and on. You know, but in the end, the guy's just going to look at it and go, man, am I really that pale? You know, or mm-hmm. it makes me look fat. I mean, what do you say? Is the, you know, because I record people and they
right,
go, man,
right.
my voice sounds like crap, you know, or man, it just doesn't sound very, I don't know. Good, or just, you know, and I'm just like, man, just, that's what you sound like. What do you say, man?
Well, I think what you say is the picture is a good way to put it. It's a good example. A recording should be a snapshot of a place and a time. And
yeah,
the truth of it is, if you look a little fat in the photograph, it's. Maybe you are a little bit. Yeah, well,
the picture adds 20 pounds.
I'll say this. I've done a lot of recordings now at this point in my career. At least it seems like it.
In your bathroom.
In my bathroom, yes. Tool shed.
And other parts of the house.
Every recording that I've ever listened back to after some time, the weakness was always me. It was never... the engineer was bad or he mixed it wrong. I could always just go back to, man, I didn't play it well. I didn't sing it well, as well as I could have. Or that's yeah. just the way I sounded back then.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the process is growing as an artist, if you will, to be pretentious for a second.
Yeah.
Is to realize
Please, that, by all
that
means.
That's part of it. That's why they call it artist development.
That's right.
Man, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I didn't sing very well. I didn't play very well. I thought I was good, but I listened back, and I've gotten a lot better. You know, the recording you and I did just a couple weeks ago, I can listen to that today. I think it sounds awesome. It's the best-sounding recording.
It's timeless. Hasn't aged at all in 2 weeks.
No.
Sounds just as fresh as when we did it.
But I can listen to it and go, man, that is exactly what I sounded like on that day. And that
yeah,
time.
Right.
That's how the band sounds. If there is any weakness on that recording, it's that's how we are. And I'm trying to tell you the truth through the recording. I'm not trying to blow smoke up your ass and make us sound like the Philharmonic Orchestra. We're a three-piece rootsy rock and roll band, and we don't always play in perfect time or sound pristine, but that's what it is, and some people like it. And if you do, you're going to enjoy it.
Amen. Man, Curtis put a great he's got a new method here that we can debate perhaps at another time.
Yeah.
The idea of not only is radio dead, like we said in our last segment, is the album could be dead.
The now, album this, has been
this
dead.
This kills me, man.
The album's been dead for decades.
I know it's dead. Dinosaurs are dead, but people still like to study and collect
dinosaurs.
We still
like to talk about it.
Talk about dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Man, because you know, I got my vinyl in here. I got my albums. I make albums. But Kurt's taking what I think is a great approach as far as you come in, you record, you know, one or two or three songs, you mm-hmm. know, and you release kind of a continuous stream of music, you know.
Right.
And that seems to satiate those fans, you know, that are coming to your weekly shows.
Right, right.
And stuff like that. I think it's a novel concept. And there's some success stories out there online about guys.
So. I think it's
song
it's
a month kind of deal, you
yeah,
know, that
definitely.
Guys that have gotten some attention doing that.
Well, and part of that is me realizing that I am not so great that I can just write 10 great songs at once and put them out. I know that I can maybe write one that I think is really good and really work on it, fine tune it, and get a really good recording of it in a timely manner mm-hmm. and get that out to the people. But if you're waiting on me to put out a classic album where every song is worthy of a listen,
then you'll go the way of the dinosaur.
You'll be waiting 6 years.
That's right.
And, you know, I like working quickly. I like coming in, getting something done, being able to get it out to the fans. It's like going to a 1 hour photo lab. You know, after you take those pictures, you can go, here it is. It's already done. You know,
yeah.
You don't have to wait a year to see those pictures. It's already out. It's done. It's history at that point.
I do think you're kind of tying into to our previous radio discussion, you know, and recording and keeping it pertinent. Yeah, the whole thing with, you know, we're going to get this song out first
mm-hmm.
on the radio.
Right.
And not release the record, you know. I think that is just, bands are killing themselves. But you still see people
ridiculous.
Doing it.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's still industry standard if you're
and
on
people
a major
are still
label.
Trying to, you know, build some sort of phony, you know, anticipation for the record. Of course,
yeah.
It used to work. I mean, back in the day, we used to stand in line for records like we used to stand in line to go see Star Wars movies.
Right,
or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, those days are really gone. And I think that's hard for, I know me as someone who's kind of, you know, lives through some of that in yourself.
Yeah,
yeah, it is. There's just an increased importance on being able to do something affordably. You know, I think we do, here at the studio, we try to provide a, you know, affordable way for people to put out music continuously. I'm always a little, you know, a little worried, you know, when someone's in here saying, man, this has got to be perfect, or that
mm-hmm.
people are going to listen to this song the rest of their lives, or
right.
this record, this CD is never going to be destroyed. It's going to be live forever on the internet. Yeah, that kind of thinking just drives you nuts.
Yeah, it can.
It just doesn't matter, man. I mean, I kind of go back to Dylan in that book, not the one he wrote, but this other one that followed his Rolling Thunder review tour, where a guy went up to him and said, hey, man, the new record, the songs, the versions on the tour are so much different than your studio versions. They've really come to life with the different guys in the band. You know,
mm-hmm.
Dylan would just go in and record his songs the first time he played through them without stopping. That was the take, you know.
Right.
He never really rehearsed or anything like that. You know, we've patterned ourselves after that, I think.
Yes.
You and I have.
To a fault.
For better or worse. But he... So someone said, man, you know, what about going out back in and recording the songs again like you're doing them with the arrangements now on the live show? Yeah, and of course that wasn't something he was going to do. I mean, he just looked at the guy and just said, man, it's just a record, man. Hell, I got
right.
20 of them. You know, just,
yeah,
you just make
true.
It and you move on. And I think the real careers, the guys you're talking about, you know, the Steve Earls and John Hiatt, the guys who make
yeah.
a record every year as long as they're alive,
right.
you and I aspire to do the same or put songs out. That's the path we've gone down, and I do think it's hard when somebody comes in and says, you know, here's my money, my uncle's behind me or whatever, and man, we got to make this thing work.
Mm-hmm.
And because if it doesn't work, I'm going back to law school or something. I'm just like, man,
right,
you know,
right.
you just can't pull that off.
Well, I liken it to, is it, if you or I were just, I mean, music is our livelihood, it's our jobs, it's how we pay our bills. And there's much more of a parallel between what we do and if we worked a real job than most people realize. That putting so much gravity on one record or one recording, saying this is going to define me for the rest of my life, that's like if you're an accountant at Pete Marwick or something and you say, man, this one day at the office is going to determine how I am the rest. And I mean, that's asinine, really.
If I don't make this deal by in the business
today, I mean,
I'll never do this again.
You know, when I go and do a recording or when you do a recording, it is just, it's, man, this is what we were doing that day.
Yeah.
In the course of our career, however esteemed our career is. And there's going to be another one next month. So don't worry about it if you don't like the last one or if we thought the last one could have been better. Hey, we've got another one coming up soon enough. There's always another battle up ahead to fight. So.
Yeah. And I think it does come from that old psyche, you know, of having a record and several singles come out.
Right.
I think in the modern music, man, you do have to just get away from that thought of time. On
yeah.
every level, because that's really
Absolutely.
What it used to. And what I mean by that is you just make a record and it just exists immediately mm-hmm. right there alongside your catalog,
yeah.
anything you've ever done.
It does.
You know, someone who goes to our P2Tunes site where you can download all the Phil Bridget records for $4 a piece, P2Tunes.com. But the whole idea of that was some dude in Germany hears the new CD or something or he hears something, oh, cool, you know,
mm-hmm.
and he sees all these records there. I want him to be able to go download all of them. It doesn't matter, oh, that's an old album, I don't want
sure.
that. Or, you know, and the new stuff just exists with the old stuff.
Right.
I tell guys in the studio, you know, you're here to just create catalog. We're not doing anything new. We're doing just something. We're just adding to the
another
puzzle
day
here.
At the office.
It's another
that's
day at the office.
Is.
You know, you're going to be a lifelong musician or not.
Right.
But you can't go to it with the approach that if this doesn't work, because even if it works, So what does that mean? You tour for a year and
you still have the rest of your life to
play casinos and pig fairs and
yeah,
you know, whatever. At best, I mean, as a country artist, you're going to go, ah, I'm playing the fair and we're opening for, you know,
Trace Adkins.
Yeah, whatever.
Rock and roll, man.
Got a co-write with a
song that you and I did together in here with the band Watertown.
Yeah.
The most satisfying part of that whole process, besides the fact that it came out great, was I wrote the song, recorded it, and released it all within 3 weeks. That was the most satisfying feeling
Urgency.
I've ever had. It is putting that song up right along with all my other stuff, almost immediately it felt like, you know, from the time that it was conceived to the time that other people are hearing it, was a very small window. And that felt good to do that. Because that's not the way I've worked in the past. And, it was just another day at the office for us. It was just
another day at the office cutting a classic track.
That's right.
For Kurt South at Trinidad World Recording.
That's right.
Well, coming up in our next little segment here, we're going to do a little bit more album talk here. Only this is going to focus on me, Phil, P2, as we look deep, Kurt, into the recordings of Phil's very first record. Sorry.
Got my scuba gear on.
Did I just refer to myself in the third person there? I apologize for that.
You do that a lot now.
Yeah, well, it's confusing. It's confusing. We're going to look at some of those tracks on the very first solo record I ever made. A record, if that's what you want to call it. Phil World, 1996. We're going to revisit it here in our final segment coming up in just a minute. Stick around.
I'm still there.
Here in the cozy confines of Trinidad World Recording, my recording studio here in Fort Worth, where we have cut great Pritchett and the Full Band records, Kurt South Records, who joins me here today. Hello, Kurt.
Hello, hello.
And, many other artists we'll be talking about in the podcast to come. But here today, and I know Kurt is just on the edge of his seat here, as a diehard Pritchett fan from way back. Back before I gained a friend and lost a fan. That's what happens at all these deals.
The curtain was pulled back.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that is what happens out there. You play a show, your one guy shows up, you know, in Houston or Corpus. He's down on the front. He's wearing the Pritchett shirt. He's cheering. He loves it. I'll do it. Man, hey, how can I be a part of this? You know, they want to be a part of something going on.
Absolutely.
So I say, hey, man, sell the merch. And then I say, man, get us some beers on the stage. And then, hey, man, what else you want to do? And then after a while, you just totally beat them down. They're just like, whatever. Then you play their wedding. That's really the last show they ever see you play.
Right.
And then they just, you know, I email them occasionally. How you doing? Just, man, I got kids. I'd come to the show for real. Thanks. And I'm like, man, I gained a friend. I lost a fan.
Right, right.
So I should have just left him a fan. Just threw my guitar down, stormed off the stage.
Right.
Never looked back. They just say, man, Pritchett, he's a mystery, man. You can't figure that guy out, you know. That's one of my big regrets in my life. But I got out of college in 1994, Southwestern University, 1,200 kids. See, I wasn't smart. I had a great college experience. But if the world of Texas music anyways taught me, man, you need to go to like A&M, UT, Tech. You need to come out of college with about 40,000, 50,000 fans.
Right. Big football school.
Yeah, that's right. A big, powerful football school. We didn't even have a football team. We were small.
Did you have a good tennis team or something?
Our lacrosse team was good. Intramurals, flag football.
Badass swimmers.
Badminton team. We did indeed. We had it all. I come out of school, you know, 1,200 kids at Southwestern. And I started playing on the drag in Austin where I lived at a place called Nasties. Every Wednesday night, Nasties. And it was kind of a rugby bar. It's up there on I don't know if it's still there anymore. Guadalupe, North Drag, up there about Guadalupe and 30th Street, kind of by El Patio up there. Austin people, help me out. Is it there? Anyway, so I needed to make a record. I'd made some high school records, so I decided to go to my old friend Patrick McGuire. here in Arlington, the great Patrick McGuire. You did some stuff. You did some stuff with Patrick with.
I did some vocal tracks on an album you were producing.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
The Jamie Talbert record.
The Jamie Talbert record. Yes. Beaumont, Texas' own Jamie Talbert. The first record I produced. A lot of firsts there at Patrick's.
A lot of firsts.
I went to Patrick McGuire with my high school band, the Suburbans. Actually, my band before that, All in One, I was a freshman. This was like 86 or something like that. And Pat had converted his garage out there into a fine recording studio. He had some shag carpet in there and a Yamaha Baby Grand piano. And he had an Olympic bass. You remember those?
Yeah.
Big wood. I'm as heavy as lead. We went in there for that first high school session. I had an airline bass. Like the strings were like 2 inches off the neck, you know. I was just unplayable, you know. And it was out of tune. He just kind of rolled his eyes and goes, "Hold on." He comes back in with the Olympic. Because this first song we had this bass intro. You know. So I learned to play the Olympic bass there as a high school kid. So anyway, I knew Patrick when I was going back to do our first album. I'd written some songs. I was on a big, you know, like a lot of guys at the time, Robert Earl Keen, Lyle Lovett kind of deal. More country record. We brought in Milo Deering, who is a great guy. He plays everything with strings, you know, one of these. He has real long hair.
Great fiddle player.
Fiddle. You know, pedal steel, and guy had a nylon string guitar, steel string. He played everything, anything. Mandolin, great mandolin player. So he all that great playing on that Phil World album is him. And I was astonished. The first song on there is Dishwater Hands. There's a lot of chord changes there, mm-hmm. and it's played up between the frets. I believe we're playing D flat or something.
Yeah,
I thought it was very difficult. You know, it wasn't just your standard C. You know, G, C, and D, follow me kind of deal.
Yeah.
So Miley just whips out this yellow pad, and he listens to Dishwater Hands. Like, all this changes, man. He's just making little marks on a page. You know, it's 1, 4, 5, you know, 6 minor and all this. And he finishes the whole song, and he just stares off into space, and he looks over at me and goes, "Did you write that?" I said, "Yeah." He just kind of nodded his head real slow. That was the only thing he ever said to me. And then he just went into the room there and just cut like, you know, great, you know, all those great mandolin parts on that song.
Yeah.
But I was amazed. He just charted that song out. It was just like he'd done it so many times. Those session guys like that just
great
blow
players,
my
man.
Mind.
That's how they operate.
Gosh, man, that was eye-opening to me.
Yeah.
And so he just went in there and then he just grabbed the fiddle and did this. We did. I mean, our big tune, you know, Maria, was born of those sessions. Man, we had never played it before, me and the band. We had Mark Baker on drums, Kevin Jecker from Austin on bass guitar, played a fretless bass. Fretless bass. Do you know that?
The world needs more fretless bass players.
Yeah, Phil World and Phil Comes Alive, Kevin Jecker on the fretless bass.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, you know, kind of that sliding around. But some fun stuff there on Phil World. I think of course I don't like my vocals. You know, I'm like everybody else who records.
No one likes the way they sound.
Yeah. Have you ever heard that record? Have you heard the Phil World record?
Oh yeah.
Or do you have the old? You kind of caught up with the full band later on.
Yeah, I mean,
did you ever become aware of that, like after the fact?
Yeah, or? Heritage Way was the first album of yours I discovered in a bin. And
you must be so disappointed with me now. Man, this guy's like a acoustic Elliot Smith kind of guy. Drake thing.
I found it in a bin at a Sam Goody Northeast Mall in Hearst, Texas. And that was my first introduction. And that was right before I saw you live the first time at the Bronco Bowl, at the back-to-school bash.
The Bronco Bowl.
It was in like August of 98, 99, somewhere in there.
Boy, yeah.
And you were playing in the afternoon. It was you, Corey Morrow, Owen Temple.
Bruce Robinson.
Pat Green.
And
I can't remember who else.
There's a bunch of other ones.
Yeah, I mean, it was just this all-star lineup chock full of
all-star
would-be legends. I mean, it was like the Beatles and the Stones and just all these bands all in one
with
place.
Cheap Trick going on at 2 o'clock.
Yeah. And I remember I walked in and you were on stage at the Bronco Bowl just playing a G&L Telecaster.
That's right.
Jumping around.
My old Cherry Burst G&L.
Yes.
Jumping around.
Which we later saw in a guitar shop in Austin for sale.
Oh. When
That's
did I
another
get rid of that
story
guitar?
In and of
that
itself.
Is another guitar. I think I traded that when I got those amps. Did I give that away?
You and I were in Austin Vintage Guitar one day. Eric Johnson was in there, too.
Yeah.
And,
he lives in there, I think.
You, me, and Jordan Powell were on our way from somewhere to somewhere.
Our old great road manager, Jordan Powell, some of y'all probably know. But
And you look up on the wall and you go, that's my old GNL up there.
Yes, that's right.
Remember
that's
that?
Right. Yeah, that's right. I had traded it for two amps
right.
that later got stolen that's in the great right. gear heist of 2004, whenever that was.
That dark day.
Gosh, we'll have that for another podcast. But anyway, that's it, man. Phil World. Phil World, 1996. You can get it for $4. And you can get all the records for $4 a piece at p2tunes.com. We want you to have it all. So go there, you can get it all. And also available on iTunes as well. Actually, I don't know if it's up on iTunes yet. I haven't gotten it up there. I need to find a copy of it soon.
Need to get on that.
The P2 Tunes, it's there. Phil World. Well, I want to thank Kurt for being here today. Hopefully he'll be joining us most weeks in here for some conversation and other things. So for Phil Pritchett and Kurt South, we're going to be signing off on this inaugural episode of the Phil Pritchett Podcast. I think it went pretty well.
Yeah, it was
great. We're feeling our way along here.
If I were listening, I'd be impressed.
By the way, please email phil@philpritchett.com if you have some questions, some topics, some issues you want to see addressed on the show. What do you think we're doing this for? We're doing this all for the fans. That's what we do. Phil Pritchett and the full band. So shoot us an email. Let us know what you want to hear us discuss or talk about or do. And we will try to get to all of those things. So happy listening. Once again, this is Phil Pritchett signing off. Take care.